All right, welcome back everyone for another deep dive. This time, we're going way back to ancient Israel, like way back to explore Solomon's Temple.
Ooh, Solomon's Temple.
But, you know, it's more than just some old building, right? We're going to like really unpack all the symbolism in its design and how it reflects a totally different worldview from everything around it at the time.
Absolutely.
And our guide for this deep dive is Dr. John Oswald. He's like this renowned Old Testament scholar.
Yeah, he's great. And one of the things that Dr. Oswald points out is that the temple, while it's definitely important, it's not like the main theme of the books of Kings.
Okay, so if the temple isn't the central theme, what is? What's the real focus then?
The real focus is on covenant devotion to God shown through, you know, people's actions, how they treated each other. So, so think of the temple as like a giant tangible symbol of that devotion.
Gotcha.
But without that spiritual reality behind it, it's just an empty shell, you know?
It's like going through the motions, right? Like if you're doing all the right things, but your heart's not really in it, does it really matter?
Yeah.
Makes you wonder if those big displays back then really meant anything, if their actions didn't line up.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, this is where it gets really fascinating. Dr. Oswald points out this shocking parallel between Solomon's temple and all the pagan temples of that era. Like they were so similar in layout. And even shared decorations.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, think palm trees, pomegranates, even like cherubim.
Wait, hold on. Like the cute little baby angels we see in paintings.
Not quite. They probably look more like sphinxes. But the point is, they were common in both Israelite and Canaanite temples.
Okay, so if they're so similar, what set them apart?
One crucial difference, the inner sanctuaries.
Okay.
Canaanite temples, they had all those idols, their representations of gods. But Solomon's temple held the Ark of the Covenant.
That's a huge difference.
Right. It shows like a completely different worldview. Dr. Oswald suggests that, you know, God often works by taking existing forms and transforming them. He uses the example of like repurposing a familiar song, but putting new lyrics to it.
So it's like God was using a language that they already knew, something familiar, but giving it this whole new meaning.
Exactly. But there's a potential downside. You know, the form, the outward appearance, it can kind of overshadow the content, the real meaning.
Okay.
And that can lead people to just focus on rituals instead of genuine transformation.
Right. You can get so caught up in the ritual, the spectacle of it all, that you miss the deeper message. Happens all the time. And not just with religion, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, art, music, even political movements, they can all fall into that trap.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, so besides the idols, what else made Solomon's temple different?
Well, the temple's design, it emphasizes symmetry and like square shapes a lot more than the typical Canaanite temple.
Okay.
You know, it might seem like a small detail, but Dr. Oswald suggests it reflects a belief in God's order, God's purpose in the world. You know, it's a stark contrast to the kind of chaotic nature you see with those pagan deities.
Wow. So even the shape of the building was making a statement.
Exactly. And it makes you think, how do we express order and purpose in our own lives, even in our own spaces?
It really does. It's something to think about. But you know what else is interesting? That there was no idol representing Yahweh in Solomon's temple. That seems like a really bold move for that time.
It's definitely a powerful statement.
Yeah.
It signified God's transcendence.
Hmm.
He's beyond human comprehension and cannot be contained or represented by any physical object.
That's a good point. It really shows how we try to define God, put him in a box, make him something we can grasp. But the truth is, he's bigger than any image we could ever create.
I think that's a great point. And it challenges our human need to simplify and categorize everything, even the divine.
Okay, speaking of challenging assumptions, I was struck by the fact that Solomon spent twice as long building his own palace as he did the temple. 13 years versus 7. Doesn't that make you question his priorities a little bit? Like, was he really devoted or just a little power hungry?
Yeah, it's a compelling question. Honestly, it does raise some doubts.
Yeah.
But remember, the Bible portrays people, even kings, you know, all their complexities and flaws.
Right.
And perhaps it's just a reminder that even the wisest among us, we all grapple with conflicting desires.
It is a good point. It's easy to like put historical figures on these pedestals. But maybe Solomon's story is just reminding us that we all have our own potential pitfalls.
Right.
You know, like those temptations that lead us away from the things that really matter.
And that makes his story all the more relatable, right?
It does.
It's not just some tale about a king from a long time ago. It's like a mirror reflecting our own struggles with temptation and ambition.
Speaking of reflections, Dr. Oswald goes into some detail about all the symbolic furniture inside the temple.
Yes, he does.
There's so much packed into each element.
There is. Let's start with the altar of burnt offering. Just imagine this altar, a constant reminder that actions have consequences, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes those consequences require genuine sacrifice to set things right.
It's a powerful image, and it resonates even today. Mm-hmm. We still wrestle with that idea of atoning for our mistakes.
Then there's the laver. Think of it as the symbol of cleansing, of purification, foreshadowing the idea of baptism and the work of the Holy Spirit in our lives, washing away the old and making us new.
It's a beautiful image. I mean, it speaks to that universal desire for a fresh start, you know, a chance to wipe the slate clean and begin again.
Exactly. And then we have the lampstand.
Okay.
Represents God as the source of light and truth. It's like a beacon in the darkness of ignorance and sin.
Yeah. Makes you think, are we called to be like lampstands too? Shining light into those dark corners and sharing truth with others.
Absolutely. And then, of course, the table of showbread, a symbol of God as the provider of sustenance, not just physical, but spiritual as well. Imagine that table, a reminder that you're not just physically nourished, but spiritually too.
Right.
You rely on something much bigger than yourself.
It's so easy to take that for granted. The food we eat, our relationships, even the air we breathe.
Absolutely. And finally, we have the altar of incense, a beautiful representation of the prayers of the faithful rising to God. Picture your prayers like sweet incense ascending up to the throne of grace.
It's powerful. All of these symbols invite us to think about how these ancient principles still apply to our lives today.
They offer this timeless blueprint, you know,
yeah,
for spiritual living, a guide for navigating all those complexities in life and staying connected to something greater than ourselves.
Okay. But we can't forget the most important thing in the temple, the Ark of the Covenant, right in the Holy of Holies, containing the tablets of the law. It symbolized the covenant between God and Israel, a relationship built on both grace and obedience.
Yes, it's a reminder that God isn't this distant, you know, unapproachable being.
Right.
He entered time and space, offering a way for us to be reconciled to him.
You know, it really makes you reconsider our whole relationship with God. He's both transcendent, beyond our understanding, and yet so intimately involved in our world.
It's a concept that still challenges and inspires us even today.
It really does. And Dr. Oswald goes even deeper and contrasts these two competing worldviews that were present at the time.
Yes, he does.
On the one hand, you have that pagan worldview of continuity, where the lines between gods, humans, and nature, they're all kind of blurred together.
Right. It's like everything is interconnected. Everything flows together. He uses the example of the Canaanites believing they could influence the weather through, let's just say, certain rituals.
Okay. Yeah. I think I get the picture.
Yeah.
So what about the Israelite worldview? How is that different?
The Israelite worldview, the one embodied in the temple, emphasized God's transcendence. He's totally separate from creation. He's not bound by its limitations or subject to his whims. He is the creator and we are the creatures.
So it's not about us trying to become gods or control God, but recognizing that we're part of something so much bigger than ourselves, something we didn't create.
Exactly. And this distinction, it's crucial because it shapes how we understand everything.
Yeah.
From morality to our relationship with the natural world.
Okay.
Dr. Oswald points out that in that pagan worldview, there are no real boundaries. Anything goes.
Yeah.
But in the Israelite worldview, God sets limits. He defines what is good and what is evil.
So it's like he's saying, I made this world and I know how it's supposed to work.
Exactly. And that's why things like bestiality and incest, they were forbidden in the Old Testament law. It wasn't just about being prudish. It was a theological statement.
Okay.
Recognizing those sacred boundaries that God established.
Wow. So the temple, with its unique design and symbolism, it was this powerful statement, like a declaration of a worldview that completely contrasted with everything around it.
It really was a beacon of light in a world shrouded in darkness. But that darkness, that tension between these two worldviews, it wasn't just some external battle.
Right.
It was also playing out in the heart of Solomon himself.
That's a great point. We were just talking about how Solomon spent 13 years building his palace. It makes you wonder, even with all this emphasis on God's transcendence and the magnificence of the temple, was Solomon truly devoted? Or was he just caught up in his own power and prestige?
Well, that's a question we'll continue to explore in part two of our deep dive.
Ooh, can't wait.
Welcome back. Last time we were kind of grappling with this question about Solomon. Was he truly devoted to God, or did that fancy palace reveal something else?
It's tough to reconcile those two sides of him, the wise king who built this incredible temple, and the guy who spent even longer building his own luxurious palace. It just feels so human, though, right? We all have those moments when our actions don't exactly match up to our ideals.
Absolutely. And Dr. Oswalt digs deeper into a specific part of the temple that might shed some light on the Ark of the Covenant. Specifically, he focuses on the lid, what's often called the mercy seat.
Okay, remind me, the mercy seat.
So every year, the high priest would sprinkle blood on the lid of the Ark. It was a symbol of atonement, covering the sins of the people.
Right, it was like a ritual cleansing. But how does that connect to Solomon's, well, less than perfect behavior?
It's in the language. Dr. Oswalt points out that the Hebrew word for cover is also used figuratively to mean atone for. Like, there's a double meaning woven into the word itself.
Wow, that's interesting. It's like a hidden message. A reminder that even back then, they understood the need for forgiveness and second chances.
Exactly. But here's where it gets even more fascinating. Dr. Oswalt explains that according to scripture, God spoke to the people from above the ark. And he suggests that this speaking was actually made possible because of the blood, because of that act of atonement.
Oh, so it wasn't just a symbolic gesture. It was like a key to unlock communication with God.
You could put it that way, yeah. And it points to a pretty powerful truth about the nature of God. He's not some far-off, unapproachable deity sitting on a cloud. He wants a relationship with us, but that relationship is only possible because he made a way for our sins to be forgiven.
That makes sense. It's not about us trying to earn God's favor or twist his arm to get what we want. It's about responding to his grace, recognizing he's already reached out to us.
Precisely. And Dr. Oswalt argues that all of this points forward to a time when access to God wouldn't be restricted to a particular place or ritual. He sees the temple, especially the ark, as foreshadowing the ultimate act of atonement, the sacrifice of Christ.
So it's even way back then, they were getting glimpses of this idea of unrestricted access to God. That's amazing.
It really is. But let's circle back to those two contrasting worldviews Dr. Oswalt talked about. You know, the pagan worldview of continuity and the Israelite worldview of transcendence. I think it's worth really unpacking what those terms mean.
Yeah, I agree. It's easy to get lost in the jargon. Could you break that down for us?
Sure. Remember, Dr. Oswalt described the pagan worldview as one of continuity. There's this blurry line between the gods, humans, and nature. It's like everything's interconnected, all flowing together.
Yeah.
He uses that example of the Canaanites believing they could influence the weather through those rituals.
Right. They saw the gods as like embedded in the natural world, almost like forces of nature themselves.
Right. Exactly. But the Israelite worldview, the one reflected in the temple, was completely different. It emphasized God's transcendence. He's totally separate from creation, not bound by its limitations or subject to its whims. He's the author, the creator, not a character in the story.
So it's not about us trying to become gods or control God. It's about recognizing that we're part of this huge thing, something we didn't create.
And that's a crucial difference because it shapes how we see everything, from morality to how we treat the environment. Dr. Oswalt points out that in that pagan view, there are no real boundaries. Anything goes. But in the Israelite worldview, God sets limits. He defines what's good and what's evil.
That's an interesting point. It's like those limits are there to protect us, to help us live in harmony with God's design.
Exactly. Think about it this way. In a world where anything goes, where there are no boundaries, there's ultimately no real meaning. Everything just becomes random.
It's like living in a world without gravity. Nothing is grounded.
Exactly. But the Israelite worldview, with its emphasis on God's transcendence, on those boundaries he set, provides a framework for meaning and purpose.
It gives us a point of reference, like a moral compass, to figure out this crazy thing called life.
Mm.
And, you know, this tension between those two worldviews, between living within those boundaries and wanting to break free from them. It's something we still deal with today.
Oh, absolutely.
It's that constant battle between doing the right thing and doing what feels good in the moment, right?
It's that and more. It's about how we see ourselves in relation to the world. Do we think we're masters of our own destiny, free to make up our own rules? Or do we acknowledge a higher power, a source of authority bigger than our limited understanding?
Whoa, those are some big questions. And I think they link back to that question we keep coming back to about Solomon. Did he truly embrace the Israelite worldview? Or was he maybe subconsciously still holding on to some of those pagan ideas? I mean, a palace twice the size of the temple, that's a pretty big statement, isn't it?
It is. It raises the question of whether his heart was truly in line with God's, or was he maybe trying to create his own kingdom down here. Something to think about.
Definitely. And Dr. Oswald explores this even more as he looks at the layout and symbolism of Solomon's entire royal complex.
Stay with us as we uncover more about this incredible time in history.
Welcome back to our deep dive on Solomon's Temple. I'm still thinking about those two worldviews, you know, that push and pull between God's boundaries and that human urge to just break free.
Yeah, that struggle. It's like baked into human history, right? And when we look closer at the archaeology from Solomon's time, it seems like this tension wasn't just in his head, it was in how he built his whole kingdom.
Oh, really? What do you mean?
Well, Dr. Oswald, he shows this diagram of Solomon's entire royal complex, and it's huge, makes the temple look tiny.
So we're talking more than just the temple itself, like all the buildings and stuff around it.
Exactly. It's called a royal complex because the temple was just one piece of a much bigger plan.
Okay, I'm picturing it. What was this whole complex like?
Okay, so you've got the temple, obviously. But then there's Solomon's palace, another one he built for Pharaoh's daughter. The House of the Forests of Lebanon, that's where he kept his weapons. All these golden shields, a throne room, a hall with pillars. It just goes on and on.
Wow, he really went all out. Like he was trying to make his own little world in Jerusalem.
Yeah, you can't ignore that display of power and wealth. And when you think 13 years he spent building this complex, twice as long as the temple, it makes you wonder what he really cared about most.
It's like those crazy construction projects we see now. You know,
yeah.
Huge skyscrapers, sprawling cities, like pushing the limits of what humans can build.
That's a good comparison. And just like those modern marvels, Solomon's complex shows our ambition, that desire to leave our mark. But was it lined up with God's plan? Or was he trying to build his own kingdom that, like, competed with God's kingdom?
That question hits home, doesn't it? We all get caught up in our own goals, wanting success, wanting people to know us. It's easy to forget the bigger picture.
It is. And what Dr. Oswald does, by looking at the temple and that whole royal complex, I think he challenges us to look at our own hearts. Ask ourselves, what are we building our lives on? Stuff that will last, that fits with God's purpose? Or are we chasing stuff that doesn't matter? Empty achievements.
It's like that saying, building on solid rock versus shifting sand.
Exactly. The choices we make, what we focus on, that's what decides what we leave behind. Will people remember us for the big stuff we did, what we owned? Or for the lives we touched, the love we gave, the good we did in the world?
I think that's one of the biggest things we learned from this whole deep dive. Solomon's story isn't just some old history lesson. It's like holding up a mirror to our own struggles, our own temptations, how we have to choose between what fades away and what lasts forever.
And it shows us that even the wisest people can mess up, can forget what's truly important. But there's hope, too, because in the end, God's grace is bigger than our mistakes.
His love can fix even our worst choices.
Yeah. So as we go through life, let's remember that what we build that matters most, it's not made of bricks or stone. It's made of love, compassion, and living the way God intended.
This has been an amazing journey. I hope everyone listening will take some time to think about their own lives, what matters to them, what are you building, what are you building on? And most importantly, is your foundation strong enough to handle anything life throws your way?
Let those questions guide you as you figure out how to live a life that's meaningful.
Thanks for joining us. Until next time, keep exploring, keep asking questions, and keep diving deep.